This episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by St. John's College Graduate Institute, offering discussion-based master's degree programs for Western liberal arts or Eastern classics, as well as summer programs in ancient Greek, film studies, and Islamic classics. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI for more information. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI.
You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who were at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 116 was something like, what can dreams tell us about the human mind? And we read sections from Sigmund Freud's On Dreams from 1901, and a small part of The Interpretation of Dreams from 1899, as well as the lecture Revision of the Theory of Dreams from 1933. You can join the discussion, get the text, and lots more information at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Linsenmeyer, repressing in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin, fulfilling wishes in Austin, Texas.
This is Wes Alwyn in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey, latently in Middleton, Wisconsin.
Well, Wes's was the most latent of all.
That's right. Very latent. So I think maybe a better question would be, are dreams interpretable, or do dreams have meanings? What was the question again, Mark?
What can dreams tell us about the human mind? I just wanted to make it sound like actual philosophy.
See, we have to just get you off of that, Mark. This is the Partially Examined Life. This isn't just a philosophy podcast.
It is. It's just that philosophy is so wide that it goes hither and thither.
Then you shouldn't have to make it sound like philosophy.
We should say the ground rules for our discussion, that we can then, the censor will come in. And I don't know if the rules are the instrument of the censor or the rules will be themselves censored. But number one, try to not to assume that our audience has read what we're talking about or has any other background in philosophy. Number two, don't make arguments that hinge on something other than what we've agreed to read. Don't say you would know what I was talking about if only you'd read Obama's Freudian diary, Dreams of My Father as a 10-ton goat. Number three, we will be rigorous and exact in all that we say, unless doing otherwise would be potentially more entertaining. All right. We should deal with the elephant in the room. Why does this episode, right in the title there, say part one? That's crazy, and it's shorter than usual. What's going with that?
We're splitting our episodes into two parts for release.
People complain that these things are too long. They can't listen to it on their commute or something. So now they're bite-sized, but we're still recording them the same way. We're still going to talk here for 3 hours or whatever, and we're going to chop it down. And if you don't like it cut up like this, actually, you can become a PEL citizen, and you can get the entire thing already right now. You can get both parts together with no commercials on it. So you have your choice.
But even split up, it's still going to be longer than every other podcast in the world.
Longer and better.
Longer and better.
Except for maybe Joe Rogan.
Oh, that's true. No, you're right.
I think his can be like 3 hours if he wants it to.
Is that because he doesn't edit at all?
He has a lot to say.
It's like a conversation among comedians for hours.
Who is this?
Joe Rogan. I've actually listened to it on road trips, and he is incredibly entertaining. Like, he has that thing that Bill Burr has, which is he's just one of these talkers. He's one of these people who can talk and somehow maintain your interest for long periods of time. And he's funny, but it's more than that. It's about these stories that are actually interesting. And
it sounds like you're describing Sigmund Freud and his writing style.
Yeah.
Sort of. As I approached this initially, and I was trying to listen to it as an audiobook, it was really hard to keep attention to. It was like listening to stereo instructions is how I felt like. But by the second time through and then taking notes and looking at the actual text, I did not have that problem. I thought it was at least. So we're reading excerpts. This On Dreams book is not actually that long. The Interpretation of Dreams, his initial book, is very thick, and because it's, you know, meant to convince other practitioners. It's meant to convince psychologists that dreams are useful. They're good to use in therapy, and here's how you should. It's a sort of instruction manual, and even just the sort of review of literature part of it, the whole first chapter, goes through what everybody, all of his contemporaries, thought about dreams and the different schools of thought, and takes a long time to make any given point.
Yeah, he's sort of, the way Freud writes is he's thinking out loud, and it gives it this air of, he's letting you in on his deliberations, and he tells you when he's made mistakes. That's one of the interesting qualities about his writing, and he's sort of known as, his reputation among scholars is that he's a great writer. And in fact, in his day, he won awards for his writing. But if you want this sort of linear, structured presentation, you don't always get that. In these sort of more popular things like On Dreams, it's actually quite structured to deliver this overview to a beginner. But some of the other things we read, it's more of a meandering, I'm going to let you in on my inner reflections type of writing, which is really actually engaging, I think.
Right. So I just want to explain why we're reading what we're reading, that he published The Long Thing. And then immediately after that, within a year or two, he wrote this On Dreams, which is a much shorter distillation of the same theory.
So of the things that we read, were these lectures, were these transcriptions of lectures or notes from lectures, or was it a combination of published work slash lecture notes? Because the style is very conversational.
Just the revision of The Theory of Dreams is a lecture, and the other two are not lectures.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's an interesting thing in itself. Might be worth it for folks to take a look and read through that On Dreams, because his style is very conversational. It's very genial, very easy to follow his logic, although he likes to invent terms or use lots of terminology and stick them in there. And I got very hung up on that.
This On Dreams thing is condensed, so he doesn't have time to explain, but you'll see one day we'll do more of his metapsychology and his theory of the psyche, and you will see how meticulous and detailed he is about every little term.
He had plenty of time in this On Dreams book to very clearly state the difference between dream thoughts and dream content. It took me, I got confused using that terminology.
So what we actually assigned for ourselves was just the sections from these two books that were in the Freud Reader. So the only thing from Interpretation of Dreams is this dream that we'll talk about Irma, one of his patients that he dreamed about it. So it's an example of him analyzing one of his own dreams, or at least doing the first half of analysis, you might say. It's the looking at every little bit of it and coming up with associations. Why was there spinach in the dream? Well, I was thinking of spinach, you know, following these lines. So that's sort of the first step. And then the On Dreams was abridged, but it seemed to have something from every chapter. It's just an overview of the whole process. Now, I was trying to do the LibriVox thing again and listen to this. And the one that I found was actually called Dream Psychology. And I thought it was just On Dreams because I looked at the beginning and I listened to the beginning, and it was like word for word identical, or at least sounded like a different translation. But I realized, I think this book that I listened to from 1920, I found a written version of it, was a later elaboration of On Dreams, because it's a 200 page book that has like everything in On Dreams seemed familiar to me in it, but it had a bunch more stuff that just made every chapter, I guess, longer and poured in more examples. So I guess that just showed that this was Freud's first really big book. And the thing that he refers to is like that he would come back to again and again to assure himself that he was onto something with his whole psychoanalytic theory, that this was his primary and first way of getting in to figuring out the unconscious and the, you know, everything else he had to say about the structure of the human mind. And so partly because this wasn't getting the reception that he thought it should, or he refers to it being in the revision of the Theory of Dreams, this later lecture, as being picked up in a variety of circles, but not really credited to him. The influence he was having was not as overt and acknowledged that he thought it should be. And so he represents these same ideas a number of times to get it just right for various audiences.
Can we, and by we, I mean Wes, can we place this work kind of in the broader context of when he's writing it and how it kind of fits into the development of where he's at?
I didn't really prepare anything, but Freud was a neurologist in Vienna, Austria in the 1880s that he became a doctor. And he started to notice he had a lot of patients coming in with symptoms that weren't quote unquote organic, which is the doctor's term for something that has a cause that's purely physiological. So he was seeing what he'll eventually call people who are hysterics, who are psychosomatizing, or they have symptoms like, for instance, paralysis of a limb, which really can't be explained as anything but psychological. We see less of this today, although there have been a few recent cases of this, usually of mass hysteria in the media. For instance, a high school recently where some of the students were developing these symptoms, and then other people would develop copycat symptoms, and they actually thought they had a disease, something like Tourette syndrome, and it turned out to be completely in their heads. So rare today, probably because of the cultural and societal conditions, but he was seeing a lot of this sort of thing. So he became more interested in, you know, as opposed to the brain side of things, he became more interested in the subjective psychological side of things. And in the beginning, he was really trying to do both at once. So he was trying to develop a psychology that talks in these psychodynamic terms of states even mental states that even if they're strange and not necessarily conscious, that are in some sense recognizable as subjective. But at the same time, he's thinking on this analogy of neuroscience. So for instance, we'll see a word in this reading, cathexis, which really it's a translation of this metaphor he uses of occupation, which is like a military occupation, but he's thinking about charge. So he's thinking about the ways in which emotions attach to ideas as a kind of charge occupying a neuron, let's say, or an electrical potential. So that's sort of where all this comes from, this attempt to come up with a language which is on the border between the neurological, the physiological, and the psychological. There's some earlier works, and he worked on hypnosis for a while, and he had some collaborators, but Interpretation of Dreams is one of the first real expositions you get of a theory of how the unconscious mind is working as it displays itself.
There's also a fair bit of psychology stuff going on. It's like psychology is a burgeoning field.
Introspective psychology, yes.
I'm thinking James, and there are neurology results from different scientific studies that just have people thinking about this hard, and Freud is an example of someone who pulls some big thread of it together.
The only part of that history I'm aware of is his collaboration with Joseph Breuer, who was another Austrian physician, and Freud and Breuer co-authored in 1895 Studies on Hysteria. I really don't know the history of, you know, when did people first start using this term hysteria? Yeah. Was that Freud's invention and Breuer's invention? I think so, but I'm not sure of all the climate, whether there was kind of a buzz in the air of this sort of stuff.
Well, let's just take him at his word that at least about dreams, he said that there's more scientific among his colleagues. For the most part, dismissed dreams as, you know, he uses the metaphor somewhere as the hands of somebody who doesn't know anything about music running over a piano. That the instrument of the mind is letting off steam more or less at night, and that there's no sense to be made of the content of dreams themselves.
It's cognitive noise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's random, which I think there's actually a grain of truth in that Freud actually is picking up on. It's not like he does away with the randomness, because the free association is acknowledging that randomness. He's just going to say, look, the mind is highly associative, and what we call random actually displays itself in terms of these weak associative links, which under his theory will actually have stronger significance because there are forces acting upon them, like they're the clay that some other forces act upon. So you start out with something random, and then he's going to say, well, there's something more that works on that. I don't think the randomness exactly goes away.
Freud's motivation for developing this theory is ultimately therapeutic. He's trying to solve a problem that he's seeing in his actual clinical practice. And it's not some speculative, he has an actual motive that is not, strictly speaking, technical or theoretical for why he undertakes to develop this theory. And the ideas that he refers to in the work that we read are based out of many, many years of practice of seeing repeated patterns. And I think that's important just to point out, because I think he's criticized in a lot of ways for as if he's putting out some kind of a theory that he's pulling a priori out of his head. That's not the case. Now, by the same token, he doesn't, when he gives case studies and talk about the interpretation of dreams, explain how clearing up the meaning of the dream helped alleviate any kind of symptoms with the person or helped address issues that they were having.
Yeah, of course, he writes about this much more elsewhere. But he does, in the second section of On Dreams, you know, in the first section, there's this mythological explanation of dreams as having something to do with the intervention of the gods, I suppose, or something like that. And that's, of course, we've rejected that. So there are three different lines of thinking. One of them is that dreams are simply random. Another is a more poetic idea that they sort of the spirit is liberated at night. And then the other idea is a more popular meaning where, you know, there are times there are these dream books where people, you know, you look something up. What does it mean if you see a bear in a dream? Of course, these still exist. You know, oh, a bear means this. And his idea is, well, look, actually, the popular approach, which is wrong, is actually onto something. Dreams, in fact, are meaningful. And the hint that we have at this is that an analogy with symptoms. So dreams are going to, in a way, be analogous to the kinds of symptoms he's been seeing. Like, for instance, someone coming in with their arm paralyzed, or they have a pain which is psychosomatic. And in those cases, he used the method of free association to help people uncover the unconscious thoughts that were leading to that symptom. The idea is that they had repressed something, and then the energy, the cathexis, or the what he calls a quota of affect, and On Dreams he calls it a affective potential, I think, that gets attached to something else. It's sort of like steam finding some way to escape, but it has to attach itself to a new vehicle, a new idea. So that's where the symptoms come from. And the idea of psychoanalysis is to help people reattach their feelings with the actual thoughts that they're associated with, instead of them being cut in two like this and the feeling attaching itself to something else entirely. And you do that, the method of association helps the person get that connection back. And that's what he thinks is a clue to the ways in which dreams are also interpretable. It's interpretation that helps with symptoms, and it's interpretation that helps us understand dreams.
So just in case this is not obvious, as an example, if you're irrationally afraid of something, you're afraid of goats, then the therapist would have to uncover, well, what is the chain of association between goats and the thing you're actually afraid of? That this energy has traveled from the thing that you don't even want to think about, and so you're repressing, to a commonplace thing, to goats. And so somehow you're supposed to work your way back and realize what you're actually afraid of, and that would help. Does that sound right?
Yeah, what you're actually afraid of is some forbidden impulse. So for instance, yeah, right. Usually having to do with your loved ones, right? Or it's the desire to hurt people you love, or the desire to have sex with people you're not supposed to have sex with. It's these really powerful sexual and aggressive emotions. And sometimes it's not... So for instance, I saw a Jerry Springer show once where someone had a phobia of pickles. He had people with phobias on. Of course, then he would basically torture them by bringing out. So he had someone bring out this huge plate of pickles. And the person's reaction was hilarious because they were just running around the studio screaming. And of course, sometimes a pickle is just a pickle. But if someone has a phobia like that, it's the symbolism part of it screaming at you, right? It has to represent something else because obviously they're not afraid of pickles per se. So whether it's sexual or aggressive, it's, you know, the obvious connection to a phallus, right? That's the low-hanging pickle, so to speak. But... it's not always necessary to go there. But the question is how something got linked up with this, how something that was actually genuinely scary, which is not necessarily something outside of us, right? It's often has something to do with our own impulses, which are the scary, stimulating things that we can't get away from. We can't run away from them as if they were animals out in the wild. We have to find these other defenses, these repressive mechanisms to run away from them. So the question is how those scary impulses got linked up to something that seems absurdly irrelevant, like a pickle.
And Mark's description fits with analysis in general, but I think the reason why dreams become powerful and important and why it made sense to me that interpretation of dreams is a sort of foundational document in thinking for Freud is the activity of the mind is revealed in dreams as relatively free. There's, you know, one of the, it's not exactly a conceit, but one of the principles that Freud is operating on is that dream activity is in the end revealing the activity of the mind itself relatively unhindered. And so even though there's lots of compression and even repression and condensation in dreams that make them appear at first blush, often utterly absurd or random or so forth, they are the mind doing what the mind does. And by analyzing that, you can get some sort of free access to what the person's actually thinking about.
And what I found fascinating in this is as a structural exercise in teleological systems, he doesn't even talk, I think, maybe he does use this terminology some places, but about the mind as a whole doing something, that at least the ultimate conclusion of his system is for his analysis to work, it's as if there were two agents working, the primary and the secondary process, he sometimes calls them, or the foreconscious and the repressed unconscious, he sometimes calls them. One is the one that has the repressed wishes, the violent, the sexual, blah, blah, blah. And the other is the sensor that is working on it, and that they're both working toward their own goals. Of course, they're in a unified system, so it's kind of like the organs in the body. It really seemed an interesting exercise to try to figure out, instead of thinking, why is this complex machine functioning like this? Well, because it has these independent systems within it, each of which has its own teleological goals. And so the apparent behavior is the compromise of those two systems working in some ways against each other and in some ways as a harmonious whole.
One of the interesting parts about this is the idea that you have these two different pieces of your brain or two different pieces of your consciousness or identity,
I think he thought they were pieces of the brain, ultimately. He invites, like, come on, physiologists, figure out what the corresponding things are. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we haven't gotten into the details, but essentially what he's saying is there's a part of your brain that wants to deal with the ugly stuff that Wes mentioned earlier, and there's a part of your brain that isn't up to dealing with it. So the part that wants to talk about it is your unconscious. The part that can't deal with it is your conscious. And then there's a function in play that protects your consciousness from your unconsciousness. That, I have to believe, when he proposed it, particularly thinking about the development of philosophical and psychological notions of identity and the self, had to have just made people fall out of their chair. What's, I think, interesting about that is, one, why would there be that protection mechanism in the first place? What is it that makes the consciousness so poorly constituted to be able to deal with its own drama? And then, secondly, why are the things that are considered threatening, threatening?
I'm not sure if we want to call it poorly constructed, because on one interpretation, you might think it's ingeniously constructed, and it's constructed to cope with stimuli. One of the predicaments consciousness is in, right, is that many of these stimuli are internal in the sense that they come from inside. So there are lots of things we can do to respond to something outside of us that's stimulating us. You run away, it's fight or flight, but we don't have that option for something that's coming from the inside, unless we can find a psychological version of that, of the fight or flight mechanism. And that's what, for Freud, all of these defense mechanisms and repression are all about. And so they're ingenious in the sense that human beings are less prone to go straight to action like animals. So an animal, to the extent that they don't have the same mechanisms, I think, you know, many mammals actually do, but they tend to go more straight to action. Human beings can do other things. So for instance, if you think about daydreaming or fantasies, one thing that's really informative to think about the daytime version of dreaming, and I think they actually are related, that's a way of managing impulses. So if you feel sexual urges and you have no other way of satisfying them, that's a substitute gratification. That's a release valve. That's enormously helpful, let's say. Because otherwise you might get yourself into a lot of trouble. And that's just an early version of other more advanced things, like being able to use symbols or words instead of simply acting, that serves as a substitute. Ultimately, these are ways of coping with the strength of the stimuli that we can't run from and that we can't act on. And we can't act on them because, unlike animals, we live in a civilization that says no, 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 no to a lot of things. That's one of the things we got with civilization and its discontents and the concept of the superego or the conscience. And we saw this in Nietzsche as well, this idea that it's this inhibition of instincts. That's the big problem. And that's why human beings have, for Freud, these mechanisms to deal with the fact that we can't simply express our instincts whenever we want.
I want to make a distinction there between being aware that you have the instinct and refraining from acting on it versus there being a mechanism in your brain or your mind that prevents you from encountering the instinct in the first place. And so if we contrast and we think about traditional philosophical pictures of the brain that oppose rationality and emotion, the rational and the appetitive, the desiring part of the mind or the soul versus the rational part, the presumption is that the rational part should always be aware of what's happening and should have the power to overcome or restrain any of the urges that come from the other appetitive parts, of course, not including things like hunger and those sorts of things.
But if you're Schopenhauer or something, yes, even that, if you're really awesome, that is the height of virtue to be able to overcome yourself. But go on.
And you see in a figure like Nietzsche, this attempt to overthrow that structure, or at least challenge it, by talking about how the rational part is put in service of the morals or culture to overcome that appetitive part. And Nietzsche says he's still accepting that framework, but he's saying you have to be willing to recognize how your rationality or how your will is being controlled and determined, and be willing to overcome that and welcome and accept those appetitive parts of your soul. And then what Freud is doing here, it just seems so radically different. He's talking about the same kind of mechanism, the mechanism that makes you repress or control those desires. But instead of framing it in terms of a rational part that is aware of but controls this other part, he's saying this happens completely before your consciousness even gets a hold of it. In other words, the rational part of your brain never has a chance to ever even encounter this. I know I'm just kind of stating the obvious here, but it just seems so completely radical a thought. It feels to me like it's worth calling out and trying to place it into this, what we think of as a philosophical framework about how we traditionally think about these things.
I think Nietzsche is actually quite analogous in some ways. His concept of forgetting that we see in Genealogy of Morals and in On Truth and Lie has some overlap with repression. And then if you look at some of his examples in Genealogy of Morals of, for instance, people saying, love your neighbor, but it's completely fueled by aggression. It's really hate your neighbor cloaked as love your neighbors. Nietzsche is full of these areas where he's exploding people's bullshit, what they believe consciously, which is really unconsciously, obviously the opposite. So this is something Freud would call a reaction formation, and we see it in people, for instance, who obviously they have that air of, right, of I'm so kind and I'm so nice, but you can feel the aggression, and then so we call them passive aggressive, and there's lots of different manifestations of that. So I think it's all there in Nietzsche, including this idea of instincts being turned inward. For Nietzsche, the soul is that's the cave carved out when the instincts get turned inward.
What was new to me in reading Freud this time, in the Freud Reader, I did a search on Schopenhauer, I did a search on Nietzsche, and that apparently Freud actually was not a big fan of philosophy. He's certainly thorough. You know, he's talking about dreams. He talks about, here's what Aristotle thought about dreams, even mentions Schopenhauer. But according to the intro here, and then in something that he said himself in one of these later articles that in the collection, that he really avoided those two figures to save himself intellectual embarrassment, he says. He knew that they had already tread similar areas to where he was treading. And because he really thought he was doing science, these other folks having an obviously different approach, that he didn't read Schopenhauer till late in his life and really didn't read much Nietzsche at all. Anyway, that was new to me because there is so much of this that sounds like a direct inheritance, but it just must have been something that was in the culture at the time rather than Freud ripped off Nietzsche.
Well, yeah, we know he read some Nietzsche, but he wasn't a Nietzsche scholar. You know, this is one of the things Brian Leiter was encouraging me to do a dissertation on, was the Freud-Nietzsche connection, because it's not really well covered enough in the literature. That may have changed.
Did you read Descartes, Passions of the Soul?
I would think he probably would as part of his education, but he did have a lot of negative things to say about philosophy. I think he was kind of like a typical science guy in this. So even though we think of Freud as, you know, he's commonly thought of as outdated or maybe impractical, that's the way he thought of philosophy. He was interested in people and their symptoms and curing them.
He was a clinician, ultimately.
Yeah, he's also interested in finding the hidden truth in our minds to fix things in the world, the clinician part. But the dreams, interpreting them, is a kind of finding a key to open up a new doorway. And to me, I mean, he has lines in On Dreams that are, you could just like rip it right out of Galileo and his understanding of what he was doing with mathematics and the physical world. He's finding a new way to open up the mind.
And thought again that there were supposed to be physical correlates to everything that he was doing, that he was, you know, it's as if he found a vacuum cleaner. Nobody had ever seen a vacuum cleaner before. And he's trying to figure out from its behavior and the way when it breaks, what sort of systems, how the motor must work, how the bag must work, whatever the systems are within it, so that theoretically one could then build a new one.
You mentioned this before, Mark, about, hey, find the what's going on in the brain. And there actually is a lot of neuroscientific research looking at, was Freud right about this? Was Freud wrong about this? That's a very active area. One basic book that people can look at if they're interested in the overlap is a book by Mark Solms, The Brain and the Inner World, I think it's called.
In the end of section 5, where he's been talking about displacement and stuff, we'll get to that. He says, if displacement takes place in addition to condensation, what is constructed is not a composite idea, but an intermediate common entity, which stands in relation to the two different elements, similar to that in which the resultant in a parallelogram of forces stands to its components.
Yeah, you're getting at the psychodynamic aspect of this, the sense in which he thought about this, yes, in terms of forces and resultants. And
maybe something short of mathematical, but definitely structural, and such that if you know one part, then you can figure out something about another part. I guess that's one of the big things in here, is there's figuring out to be done, and that figuring out is available because there's a logic to it. It's possible to figure out things about dreams and about the relationship to individual people's minds and to the way our minds work in general, because there's a logic and structure to it.
So he talked first about the application of free association for people's symptoms, and then he's going to apply it to his own dream to try to show us how this, what he calls the manifest content of the dream, is a result of what he calls dream work, which has worked over these latent dream thoughts and turned those thoughts into something else, something pictorial and something distorted in several ways. And Dylan, what you were just talking about is one of those ways in which the distortion occurs on condensation.
I did a search on Descartes. And so just at the end of the same intro by Peter Gay of the Freud Reader, there's a section called The Philosoph. And it says, like Bacon and like the 18th century philosophes, Freud could see nothing in metaphysical systems but dogmatic and ostentatious verbal constructions that in no way advance knowledge. Quite the contrary, precisely by pretending to advance knowledge, metaphysicians retarded it. The spirit of system to which such 17th century thinkers as Descartes or Malebranche seemed addicted was, he thought, infinitely less effective in securing man's conquest of the world and understanding of himself than the Enlightenment's systematic spirit. So what you were talking about exactly, Dylan, of looking at a particular mechanism and saying there is a logic to this, how does it work? That's way more useful than coming up with a system of the world. That might not be fair to Descartes.
Despite that, though, Freud really was in many ways a philosopher deep down. He was a closeted philosopher, ironically, who did not want to admit to his philosophical tendencies. So in a way, a psychoanalysis, Freud wants to think of it as a science. I don't think it is, but just in the sense I don't think psychology and social sciences really live up to the standards of the hard sciences. And so that's sort of their fate because they have to deal with human subjectivity. But it's at the nexus of science and philosophy and psychology. I think he's sort of at that nexus point between all three, when I say science, hard science.
Well, before we get into the Irma dream, why don't we hear about the sponsor?
This episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by the St. John's College Graduate Institute. The Graduate Institute is the master's degree granting arm of St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and there's also a campus in Annapolis, Maryland. I went to St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland. I went to the undergraduate program, but they're very similar, where the undergraduate program is 4 years, the graduate program is 2 years. And it's a very unique sort of program involving reading what they call the great books of the Western and Eastern canon and then discussing them around the seminar table. So for undergrad, that's quite unique because many students will be used to sitting in on lectures. So while seminars are more common in graduate school, this is a unique sort of seminar where the students run the show. And the professors, we actually call them tutors, are there to guide the conversation. But they're not in charge of the conversation in the same way that a professor in a typical, even graduate classroom takes charge of the conversation. The other aspect of this is a typical graduate seminar, you're reading a ton of secondary reading, and at St. John's, you just focus on original source texts. The idea is to do the work of thinking through those texts and interpreting them for oneself before you get to the stage where you're reading what everyone else has said about them. Like PEL, the Graduate Institute attracts a community of people who are passionate about the life of the mind and passionate about doing thoughtful readings of and having serious discussions about the greatest books ever written. When I talk about St. John's to people, I tell them it's one of the greatest educations in the world that you can get. The Graduate Institute is currently accepting applications for summer 2015 and subsequent terms. Decisions are made on a rolling basis. There's no application fee. The only requirement is a bachelor's degree, and that can be in any field. So for more information, visit partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI.
All right, let's get back to it. So were we going to talk about the Irma dream from the interpretation of dreams now, or were we going to talk about On Dreams more?
I read the Irma dream first, and then I read On Dreams just because that's the order they came in the book. But On Dreams has this sort of fairly careful exposition with some examples in it of how to interpret dreams. And then on the one hand, the activity of interpreting dreams and what you're doing there. And then also what the resultant structure and underlying features of dreams are in general.
Either one was a fine introduction. In the Irma dream, we see the first half of the procedure. So the overall structure is, first of all, write down your dream. But probably as soon as you write it down, you're making stuff up about it. You're making it more coherent than it is. So if you think it has an obvious meaning, just undo that. And instead, you want to focus on the pieces of the dream. So the first half is the work that you give to the person who's having the dream. And this is what he does himself in the Irma dream, which is he takes the pieces of it. After telling it, he takes the pieces of it and he goes through what are the associations with this element and this element and this element. The second half then is what the therapist has to do with, okay, now I've got all these associations that my patient has explained to me. What sense can be made of that? How do I figure out from there what the latent content is? That the dreamer himself, if he's not a doctor, if he's not familiar with the technique, is not going to be able to get any farther than these associations. In fact, the associations will often stop short of the important part, the thing that's really bugging him, the thing that was being repressed that had been transformed into the manifest content of the dream. He's going to need some prodding in order to spit that out. It seemed like the on-dream stuff was giving the whole picture of what the therapist does and sort of the theory behind that. There's a fine dream example that starts off on dreams about the green eyes. Is that a simpler one?
Yeah.
You want to read the green eyes dream?
Sure.
Why don't we have Seth read the green eyes dream?
All right. I will now show what results follow if I apply this method of investigation to dreams. Any example of a dream should in fact be equally appropriate for the purpose, but for particular reasons, I will choose some dream of my own, one which seems obscure and meaningless as I remember it, and one which has the advantage of brevity. A dream which I actually had last night will perhaps meet these requirements. Its content, as I noted it down immediately after waking up, was as follows. Company at table d'hôte. Spinach was being eaten. Frau E.L. was sitting beside me. She was turning her whole attention to me and laid her hand on my knee in an intimate manner. I removed her hand unresponsively. She then said, "But you've always had such beautiful eyes." I then had an indistinct picture of two eyes, as though it were a drawing or like the outline of a pair of spectacles. This was the whole of the dream, or at least all that I could remember of it. It seemed to me obscure and meaningless, but above all surprising. Frau E.L. is a person with whom I have hardly at any time been on friendly terms, nor, so far as I know, have I ever wished to have any closer relations with her. I have not seen her for a long time, and her name has not, I believe, been mentioned during the last few days. The dream process was not accompanied by effects of any kind.
By affects of any kind, yeah.
Affects.
Right. So it was no emotional component to the dream. He didn't have any strong feelings during the dream.
I did not have any strong feelings accompanying the dream.
Here and in other dreams that he talks about, and then in the Irma dream, I got very interested in the way the dream itself was written down as a text, because ultimately it gets analyzed as a text. So this section that Seth read, starting with company at table and ending with a pair of spectacles, itself has an important structure to it, both in it not having complete sentences, as it being kind of notes. There are these ellipses that are in there that are part of the text and meant to and break it apart in certain ways. It's supposed to be a kind of stream of consciousness, but it's not exactly that way because there is a kind of self-reflection going on when he says, "I then had an indistinct picture of two eyes." That's almost as if he is describing his dream and saying what happened in it, but it's not actually the dream itself, like a basic rendering of the pictorialness of it. It's including a narration of it that is coming from him being awake and remembering it.
Yeah, so that's the part he calls secondary revision, which for him is a very important part of all of this.
It wasn't what we read.
It's in the reading called secondary revision, or the revision theory of dreams.
Yeah, actually, that was one of the few notes I took from that later.
Oh, really?
The 1933 lecture.
I must have glossed over that.
Yeah, it's part of it. It's not the whole.
It's the thing that he warns about. When you do this, don't try to make it make more sense than it does. That a lot of people, when they're they're telling the story, he's not going to make this mistake, of course.
You're talking about writing it down. Yeah, okay.
But in a way, it's part of the dream. So your wishes, your desires, okay, they influence the way you write it down as well. To me, it's actually the least interesting part of all of this.
I wasn't trying to draw our attention to the least interesting part. Thank you, Wes.
No. I'm not saying that you're wrong to be interested. It's a lot of people are very interested in this, and it's a quirk on my part that I'm less interested in.
Well, what I found interesting was at this point now we have a text that we're going to analyze. And even if we put aside the revision part of it that's going on, so the way in which it got mediated to write it down, we're now going to analyze it as a text in individual pieces. and sort of explicate that for his associations and so forth. But the actual structure of it as a text struck me as just, because we analyze it that way, it seemed to me became important that the way it ended up being rendered as a text.
Did you guys try and write down any dreams while you were...
I haven't had any dreams while I was... Or not any that I remember.
You've probably done it at some point in your life, but if you do it more recently, you kind of... You get a better sense of the problems he's talking about when you try to remember dreams and the sense in which they're truly disjointed and how difficult it can be to make a narrative out of them, hence the ellipses or maybe the sense in which you try to make a narrative that's not there and all of that stuff. So I actually had a dream about spectacles. I had a dream sort of pivoting off this dream, but I'll tell you about that later. It was interesting to go through that process of writing it down, thinking, oh yeah, am I remembering everything?
And shouldn't you be shooting for, at some level, rendering it as plainly as possible? And so to the extent that the dreams are incredibly pictorial and maybe have associated affects with them, the goal is a sort of just the facts, ma'am, kind of attitude.
I thought he was pretty straightforward, but maybe you're right that he's not. And the interesting thing is, usually with my dreams, there's usually strong affects associated. So this idea of it having no affect is, and he thinks dreams are often that way, is interesting. It might just be his dreams and people like him that are that way.
I guess the two thoughts that I have about this, ultimately he wants to get at the dream thought, the latent content he refers to as the dream thought. And he usually talks about it as if it were a sentence. And I know we talked about that explicitly in our Lacan episode, but I don't want to recall any of those details. I've repressed them. So even though the dream itself has to transmit something that is ultimately stored in your head as linguistic to pictures, then when you're writing it down, in some ways, you're trying to just reverse the process. You're trying to, so there's something natural, even though it is a pictorial thing, of trying to write it down. Although obviously that's the secondary revision. He doesn't think that you're going to just go ahead and write the latent content, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. And the, you know, one thing Seth mentioned about, we're not clear on what dream thoughts are. And that's unfortunately true in this On Dreams. You find out in the interpretation of dreams, it can be a lot of different things. So it can be like a memory, an experience, or an impression, which is the word he uses in On Dreams. Mm. Or it can be propositional. It can be a wish. It can be a feeling or an idea. So it's really quite a broad term. It's the engine that's driving the dream, but is somehow not obviously in the dream until you interpret it, but it can be any number of different mental happenings.
Yeah, it seems like in all the examples he gave and what we read, that it's something linguistic, even if it's a desire, which, you know, of course, the wishes are at bottom some kind of desires. And he's going to say all dreams, we're jumping ahead here, are in some ways wish fulfillments, or they're trying to be wish fulfillments. But even that can be expressed as, oh, if only I had a new pony or whatever the wish is. You could say it as a sentence, and that would sort of exhaust the content of the desire. And then that seems less obvious, you know, if only I could make love to my mother, you know, if the, I don't know, it seems that there must be some different way of non-linguistic way of putting that.
So the wish has to actually be, for the most part, it has to be fulfilled, even though he makes a caveat at the end that, you remember when he talks about the dream work, the most fundamental part of the dream work is to turn the optative into the present tense. So it's not just, oh, I want to. It has to happen or be fulfilled in some indirect way, except in trauma dreams. But that's a special exception that he talks about at the end. So it's not just that there's desire motivating dreams and this wish to do something. It's that he thinks there actually has to be an element of the desire being fulfilled, because that's the way stimuli are managed. That's the way the psyche keeps itself in balance, in the same way that you fantasize about sex when you can't have sex and that restores balance. There's got to be some element of that here, he thinks.
So anxiety dreams would fall in the category of trauma dreams?
No. I mean, they could, but usually not. Usually they are just you getting too much of what you want, which is taboo, and then the anxiety is aroused. The dream has to effectively disguise it. If it doesn't do a good job, then anxiety ensues.
One more point about the linguistic thing. So that maybe I take issue with this being a text, because yes, it's a text, it's an utterance, but then you have the person who wrote the text in front of you. That's really important, that you can't, everybody write down your dreams and mail them to A Sigmund the Dream Decipherer. And he could have a column in a magazine where he would... No, that's not the way it works. Like, you have to do a lot of the work in deciphering the dream, so it's...
Yeah, you have to free associate to the dream.
Right, and I would think a lot of that is delving further into the dream, that it's not just what does spinach make me think of from elsewhere in my life. It's, can I think more about the spinach in your dream? And he wants you to fill in the details. He thinks the first time you write this stuff down, it's often the most important thing that you leave out. And it's only when you're interrogated that you come up with this missing piece that sort of unlocks the whole thing. So it's not purely a text, because you end up interrogating the speaker, not just the text itself. So you get more text out of them.
Yeah, that sounds right. But it's not that you're getting the text of the dream, right? Is you have to do, as Wes said, the free association. So you have to search for the latent content. You have to figure out, based by interrogating the patient, what it is that those elements of the dream are connected to in real life.
Wes, do you have any insight on this? Would some of the questions to the patient be like, no, tell me more about the room that you're in at the beginning of the dream? Or is it all just, what does the table d'hôte make you think of?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, psychoanalysts tend to be as quiet as possible, especially in the beginning, but you wouldn't really want to ask them questions that are that direct. You would want to get them to keep speaking if they stopped, but you're not asking them what something means. The psychoanalyst is doing the interpreting. The patient is doing a free associating. So what you want them to do is just to think of whatever comes into their head. So just exactly what Freud does in these subsequent pages, where he's just saying, oh, that reminds me of this. That's the perfect dream interpretation of method. Take the dream and say, oh, what does it remind me of? And then come back to that and do the interpreting. So Freud is acting here as analyst and analysand at the same time. But in general, one person would be doing the interpreting and the patient would be free associating.
Isn't there something really wrong with being the analyst and the analysand at the same time?
Yeah. It's a biased, it's a very, you
know. Seems like you could only go so far with it.
Yeah, that's a criticism. Freud is trying to do the best he can for illustrative purposes, and it doesn't matter if he's specifically right about this dream, right? It doesn't matter if Freud doesn't get himself, because all you need is an example of the kind of thing that happens.
He also confesses as much, especially in the Irma dream, or maybe even this one too. I think it was this one, that he really could go a lot further than this. In fact, he stopped short of going as deep as he could, almost out of embarrassment or out of being too forthright in a public setting.
Yeah.
That he should not, for the sake of writing a public document and displaying it to friends and family all over the world, that he shouldn't continue analyzing himself.
Although he will later say with this dream that what it's all about is regretting having to give money to a relative.
Yeah, but there's relatives and there's relatives, right?
So I wonder if he sort of forgot about his idea that this is too embarrassing to make public and just did it anyway, or if there's something even worse.
Well, he seemed to say that most of these wishes get down to infantile sexual desire, you know, something nasty and forbidden. So that's what I thought he was saying. He didn't want to expose himself, but maybe I was reading into that.
The forbidden stuff can be as simple as not wanting to know that you regretted having to give money to a loved one. You know, those are the kinds of things that people try not to know and often succeed.
It feels to me like Freud is kind of doing something phenomenological here, where he's taking this thing, this phenomena of our existence, which is dreaming, and he's attempting to bracket out some things and make sense of what that phenomena means to us. How is it that it is part of what constitutes our experience? And the challenge is, where we typically think of that phenomenological undertaking as being, if not rational or logical, at least taking our conscious experience as a subject matter, he's trying to go someplace that is unusual. And then essentially what he's done is, from his clinical experience, created an interpretive framework for this phenomena. And we can question aspects of the interpretive framework. But there's first the question of, has he sufficiently proven or shown that dreams have significance when there are these other people claiming they're just residual from the day or from your conscious experience? And then secondly, if he's shown that they have significance, is his interpretive framework right, or is it useful, or both? I just want to point that out, because like when Mark says, talking about getting at the infantile and whatever, that's a question specific to the interpretive framework that he's putting in place, but it's not necessarily calling into question the notion that dreams have significance.
Freud readily admits, right, that dreams have lots of significance that is has nothing to do with repressed impulses. Those will be sometimes confused in the dream, and with some analysis will display themselves. So you could buy part of his theory and not buy the other part. You could say, oh yeah, there's these associations. Dreams do work a lot like poetry in a sense. There's this symbolizing, meaning-making activity going on, but you could then reject the part that it has anything to do with repressed impulses. You could just say it has something to do with desire and impulses, but the repressed part, it's not for me.
I think the whole thing is a hypothesis, a working hypothesis that dreams are meaningful. So if we assume dreams are not just random, in fact, in the revision of the Theory of Dreams lecture, he talks about specifically that a patient, you know, you've asked the patient to do this, but the patient tells you about the dream. And so that's an utterance. And even though the patient might think, well, that was just kind of stupid. I don't know why I had that dream. The fact that the patient said it at all in a therapeutic session means you should interpret it as an attempted communication, that your hermeneutic duty is to unlock it. It's a kerygma. Is it aimed at you?
Yeah. And then your criteria.
Yeah. Run with that. Write a whole book, analyze several dozen patients using that hypothesis, and he's found it helpful. That's really what it comes down to, right?
Well, your criteria are explanatory value.
Yep.
And then practical value. So in a way, it's a lot like science in that broader sense, but then the problem you run into is what counts as explanatorily valuable is actually highly personal. You have to ask the patient, and it's never the same in the case of each patient, because every patient's little symbol world is different. And the same for practicality. How do you say whether you've helped a patient or cured a patient? It's not an empirically verifiable phenomenon. So in some broad sense, it looks science-like with those criteria, but in the narrow sense, you run into those problems.
And I found this so kind of scary when looked at in a social context that, of course, the doctor is trying to help the patient. But if you think about the cliches of the arrogant therapist with his theories, imposing them on these, especially women, to convince them that they're hysterical, end up calling them pathological because they're different. And whereas in a literary criticism context of hermeneutics, you're just like, oh, there can be multiple fine meanings that we can be satisfied with an open-ended number of meanings. But when you're actually talking about a diagnosis that is going to affect how someone is supposed to behave, it puts a lot of power into the therapist's hands that unfortunately...
It can be abused. Yes. Yeah. It's normative. You know, the concept of health is normative. But on the other hand, people are coming to Freud not because they're different, but because they are suffering tremendously and no other doctor's been able to help them because they can't find a physiological cause and blah, blah, blah. You know, there's people with paralyzed limbs and things like that.
Yeah. I like that he was struggling with it, that in the Irma dream, he talks about one of the foundations for it is that this woman had come to him for help and he'd given his interpretation. And he said, well, back then I used to see my role as telling the patient, this is what's wrong with you. He doesn't really spell this out, but here's what I think is the cause of your hysteria or whatever. And then telling them what they should do to that. And then it's on them. If they don't accept, you know, of course you would think that there would be resistance to an interpretation like this, whatever it is, because it has something to do with something they're repressing, something that they actually want to avoid that they don't like. And he's making them face it. So of course you would expect that resistance, but he thought that it's my job just to put it out. What am I? I'm not going to force them to accept my advice. So if they ignore it, it's their damn fault. And in this case of this patient, it seemed like she hadn't really taken his advice. Her symptoms had gotten better, but one of his colleagues had told him that she's not altogether better. And in fact, seemed to kind of blame him for not doing a good enough job. So that he said, you know, I've since changed my opinion of what my duties are with regard to them, that it's not just that I'm right and I tell them I'm right. And if they are not going to listen to their doctor, then fuck them.
The underlying part of this, he's trying to help them make the unconscious conscious, but he thought initially you could just tell people, you know, yeah, this is what you're repressing. That doesn't work because they may even intellectually realize it. You may give them some intellectual insight, but you have to help them hook up thoughts and feelings that have been split off from each other. And simply by telling things intellectually, you don't do the work of reuniting thoughts and feelings, and you can't get someone to fully accept something just by telling them it.
That's been my experience of 6 years of doing this with you guys. You're just not connecting. I'm not emotionally moved. I'm not connecting with the things because you're just giving me theoretical and rational reasons instead of helping me to bring this stuff out.
Well, each of us has a different role, Seth. You are we're each different parts of the psyche.
Tell us about your childhood, Seth.
I was born. Sorry, I was going to do a Steve Martin thing, but I think we've moved beyond that.
I do get the idea that there are beefs that we have. You try to make a speech to somebody and they don't really get it. And it's only 6 episodes later or 2 years later when we read more of the relevant stuff and can see the bigger picture and mull it over that our beliefs get a little more in accord.
Shall we return to this dream?
I thought by following the chain of associations, we would get to the really important part.
Because I think it's kind of brilliant the way he does this, right? Well, maybe brilliant isn't the right word, but it's informative.
Or boring. Whatever. That's what...
Is it boring?
Just in terms of relating it. Like, okay, so for each thing in here with the spinach and with the eyes, you know, he has a chain of associations. And that's the part that I felt like reading through, like, oh, what... It wasn't until I got to the end of it and could take it as a whole and say, okay, I see what the method was here, but actually wading through it or for us now to then repeat each of the points would be extremely boring. So what?
No, I don't want to do that. I mean, we can say broadly that, so he's had this dream about this restaurant and a woman hitting on him basically and telling him he has beautiful eyes and then seeing spectacles. And for each little item, he goes through and associates to it. So he associates from the restaurant to a cab ride where he talks about restaurants with his friend. He's getting a free ride from his friend. And he's talking about being conscious of the debt when he's in the taxi and the taximeter as you're watching it. And actually, that's experience I have to. That's why I like Uber. I hate being in cabs and seeing the taximeter going up and feeling tense about that. But anyway, so he goes on to talk about another experience where his wife wasn't paying attention to him and this idea that he was getting a bad bargain. She was paying more attention to strangers, association to courtship.
At a dinner.
Right. They're sitting at a table.
Yeah, that one I found immediate and interesting, how this was exactly opposite something that had just recently happened, that this woman is giving him attention. Well, his wife wasn't giving him attention. So there is the wish fulfillment right there without even having to add all the stuff about the spinach and the cab ride.
Exactly.
He wants attention. And the woman with her hand on his knee, that reminded him of something that his wife did to him while they were courting. So just exactly. Combining those two elements gives you a halfway decent interpretation of the dream, but there's more.
Yeah. At some point, this woman tells him, you've always had such beautiful eyes, and he associates from that to basically this, it's a kind of German reference from the time, but getting something for free. And then a friend who had often put him in debt, given him gifts, and the guy was an eye surgeon.
And Frau E.L. was his daughter, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so that's what maybe brought her in particular in to the...
Right. And then how he had talked to this guy about a patient that the guy was giving spectacles to. And so you get the idea here. It's just all these different associations, and they begin to converge on this kind of single idea, which is that he wants to be able to get love for free or enjoyment for free, something like that, without being put in debt. So it's something about relationships, putting responsibilities on us, but wanting love without those responsibilities.
Just the one place where it sort of crossed the line for me was after he laid all this out, the last paragraph of it. As I now perceived, almost all of the elements of the dream's content had been brought into the new context. For the sake of consistency, however, the further question might be asked of why spinach of all things was being served in the dream. The answer was that spinach reminded me of an episode which occurred not long ago at our family table when one of the children, and precisely the one who really deserves to be admired for his beautiful eyes, refused to eat any spinach. I myself behaved in just the same way when I was a child. For a long time, I detested spinach, blah, blah, blah. My own early life and my child's were thus brought together in the mention of this dish. You ought to be glad to have spinach, the little gourmet's mother explained. There are children who'd be only too pleased to have spinach. And so it sort of gets him launching about thinking about the duties of parents to their children and
Yeah. So he engages in these promiscuous, what you could call promiscuous interpretations. But he thinks he's entitled to them because he thinks that's the way the mind works unconsciously. He thinks the mind is, if I'm doing it awake, it's certainly happening while I'm asleep. He thinks that the mind is so highly associative that no matter how absurd and tangential and disconnected, well, that's just the way the mind works when there aren't these higher level processes shaping things into more coherent experience and thinking.
He has a nice quote, or a nice description of this, and his conclusion about how powerful this analytical method is right after this dream. He says, "I will pause here to survey the results I had so far reached in my dream analysis. By following the associations which arose from the separate elements of the dream divorced from their context, I arrived at a number of thoughts and recollections which I could not fail to recognize as important products of my mental life. This material revealed by the analysis of the dream was intimately connected with the dream's content, yet the connection was of such a kind that I could never have inferred the fresh material from that content. The dream was unemotional, disconnected, and unintelligible. But while I was producing the thoughts behind the dream, I was aware of intense and well-founded affective impulses. The thoughts themselves fell at once into logical chains in which certain central ideas made their appearance more than once." So central to the power of the method is recognizing the revelatory nature of this association. It's like the power of putting a puzzle together and having a picture come before you. It's the power of any kind of figuring out that you didn't understand before, that the sheer structure of it becomes the testament to it being true.
But also I was aware of intense and well-founded affective impulses.
Yes.
You know, if you guys ever start trying to remember your dreams and write them down and then interpret them in this way, this is one of the things you'll notice. And it's one of the things that makes it so difficult, which is that the criterion is emotional in a way. The criterion of whether or not you're onto a good interpretation is whether the things fit into a coherent emotional picture. And some of what seems so convincing to Freud is unconvincing to us because you kind of have to feel it. So it sounds like a cop-out, but you kind of have to be on that end of feeling it in order to fully get it.
But you're saying, Wes, that there's two parts of that feeling. On the one hand, there's that feeling of the unity of the dream. That is that feeling that most of us are familiar with of just figuring something out. But there's also the effectiveness of the result of what you figured out. So that as you become more aware of what was latently going on, what you were really thinking, you might actually become even more disturbed by it and more emotional about the whole thing, not from the process of figuring it out, but that you've become aware of something you weren't aware of before. And the power of that affective emotional reaction is an indicator of you being closer to really understanding the dream.
Yeah, that gets a little complicated. And we haven't, what he's done here is kind of the easier part, is the more obvious interpretation, because he hasn't gotten to anything forbidden yet. But I think you're right, Dylan. Often when you get to the point where you're brushing up against forbidden impulses or thoughts, the patient will stop free associating. Or if you're trying to do your own dream analysis, you might come up against anxiety. So that would be a signal that you're onto something.
So at this point that I found myself wondering about how you distinguish run-of-the-mill, boring, prancing through the meadow kinds of dreams from ones that are the source of great psychic disturbance, because he acknowledges the former. In fact, he acknowledges that they're incredibly common. But of course, the more interesting ones are the ones that are rooted in deep psychic disturbance, and of course are the ones that he focuses on because of the kinds of patients he's had in working through those dreams with them, having that therapeutic end that Seth was mentioning. But so what's the sign? You know, you want to fly around or whatever it is. I don't know.
Are you really prancing through the meadows in your dreams? Because I can tell you what that means right now.
Well, that's a separate question. This whole issue of symbolism, which seems to be juxtaposed in intention with the notion of latent content. But I'm sure we'll get to that because he talks about symbolism later.
You've brought up a lot of good stuff to preview the second half of our discussion. So why don't we start off with repression when we get to that?
All right, folks, thanks for listening to part one. If
you've got any comments so far, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com, start a discussion. You'll find part two on our feed 1 week after this part went up, or you don't even have to wait. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com, become a PEL citizen, and get the full unbroken discussion, commercial free. Thank you, and have a good week.